Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Max, we're off to the races again with the No One Fights Alone podcast. How you doing, buddy?
Doing great. Yeah. It's Friday. It's my favorite day of the week. Yeah, it's so good.
What are you doing this weekend?
Hoping that Kansas City loses the Super Bowl.
Oh, my gosh. There's no way possible.
You know, other than that, you know, I mean, it's just kind of a chill weekend, I think. Not too many plans.
I hear you. Well, it's wonderful weather in Oklahoma. I'm hoping it stays like this. I'm going to try to get my golf clubs out a little bit tomorrow, but we'll see. But I don't want to waste any more time you and I talking. I have an amazing guest that we're bringing on, Siobhan McTighe. Siobhan, welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. I'm so happy to have you on.
Thank you. It's such a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I love this. Now, you and I first met several years ago when I don't really even remember how we got connected, but I remember having a really fascinating conversation with you on the phone about your passion for keeping people healthy in this community. And that has never left me. It's always been, it's always resonated with me. It was really a fascinating conversation. And do you remember that conversation back several years ago?
I do. I remember I was in Texas at the time and I was trying to prepare a curriculum regarding officer wellness for significant others and spouses to help them understand the, I guess, nuances of the profession and open up their minds to the struggles of law enforcement.
Wow. Do you still teach that curriculum?
I haven't recently, but I still am very passionate about the topic and I definitely touch on that stuff for new officers.
Well, I hope we can visit that at some point in this conversation. That would be so we find that there's a lot of requests for that family information pertaining to that family and the keeping a marriage healthy. How do you raise healthy kids in this community? So I hope we can circle back to that at some point and visit some of that. But for today, Siobhan is an 18-year career law enforcement officer currently with Windsor Police Department, Windsor, Colorado. And Siobhan, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself I'll just tell the listeners who you are.
So I actually got into law enforcement in 2004. I am the daughter of an FBI agent. My dad was the SAC over Tri-State area out in the West. And I was always enamored with the profession since I was a little girl. I remember being 10 years old and reading my dad's books on serial killers and Mindhunter, John Douglas, Robert Ressler, you know, all that stuff. And while the rest of my classmates were doing their book reports on like Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree, I was talking about Ted Bundy. So I always kind of knew that this was the path for me. And I did my college internship in at a sheriff's department close by to where I studied. And at that internship, I decided to transition my goal from being in the FBI, like my father, to going into local law enforcement. The guys at the sheriff's office hit a house, a meth house, and I saw them all tacked out and running to go, you know, make entry on this place. And I was like, I don't want to write a desk. Like, I want to do this stuff. This is cool. So I worked at a jail for a couple of years. Just kind of getting my feet wet. And then from there, I was hired onto Fort Collins Police Department in January of 2004. And it was just like the best gift in the world. I was so excited to make my dreams come true. And yeah, it was just such an amazing opportunity. So
I love that. Now tell us a little bit about your career. So I find that I believe you had a pretty rich and robust career early on, right?
I did. So I worked patrol from 2004 to 2008, and then I got hired, or I don't know, lateraled, I guess is the better way to say it, into our Crimes Against Persons unit, which specialized in homicides, abuses against children, sexual assaults, that kind of thing. So I loved the work. Super passionate about it. I loved the ability to connect with the victims that I served, and I just kind of walk them through the criminal justice process. It was such a powerful experience to be able to witness and take part of.
What if you were to highlight some of the like more grand moments of that time? What might one or two of them be?
Well, as a detective, I would say like some of the bigger moments actually happened after the case is resolved. So, for example, I worked a murder in 2013, where a woman killed her husband, ex-husband. The case was horrific. She lay in wait and stabbed him multiple times in his home. And anyways, long story short, we ended up arresting her for the charges, and she was she took a plea deal for, I believe it was 35 years to a second degree murder. So the special part of this case, so that was the work, right? Like
right.
The successful right. resolution of the case, and just all hands on deck, teamwork kind of thing. But what was special about it was the aftermath. So the relationships that I was able to develop with this family as I walked them through the journey were really just, that's the soul work that I feel like we get into the profession for. So the victim's brother ended up being Santa Claus for my kids for years after the fact. And it was just such a special relationship in that, you know, afterwards we would have conversations, and he said, I lost a brother, but I gained a sister. So super neat. That ability to touch other people's lives in a way that is so unique to this profession, if we allow it to happen.
Absolutely. Out of the tragedy, comes some glimmers of light and connection. Through the human existence. Wow. What a neat story. Yeah. Thanks for that.
That's way cool.
Absolutely.
I had a case just similar, but anyway, I got asked to be a pallbearer. I was the lead investigator and of this death. And anyway, I got asked by the family to be a pallbearer, and I was like, holy cow, that was crazy. But yeah, neat to see the aftermath, you know, of the impact that you have.
Yeah, for sure. Just that part of healing, you know, and I think that when we fixate our eyes on that, the job becomes so much more robust and so much more meaningful. Like, I think all of us, when we sit in front of an oral board and are trying to get hired, we talk about wanting to make a difference. And we kind of, over the course of a career, there's high probability that we become disgruntled or cynical, and we lose that depth in our want to make a difference. It becomes more of a job, a number, a case, a file. But when we can hold on to that and use it to help us reconnect for why we got into the profession to begin with, I think it creates just a next level to, again, the depth of the work and, what we're actually achieving when we connect with these folks.
I anticipate we're probably going to revisit that topic, because I would love to spend some time on that. But I want to kind of keep moving forward, because you've got more to your story that I want to unpack a little bit before we start talking about maybe some resilience and some broader things in that area. Am I wrong? Let's keep going.
All right, you got it. So I guess as to kind of fall back to the beginning of my career, what led me into this, I don't know, sphere of wellness was really stuff that I hadn't dealt with at the start of my career. So I was hired on in January of 2004, and in July of 2005, I was dispatched to a structure fire. Now, the days leading up to this, like after I got my badge and gun, and made it through the FTO process, like I felt like I was Superwoman. Like I could do anything. I could kick in the doors. I could save all the people. Like, tell me what you need. I can make this happen for you. And then this call came out. And I think that when we look back on our careers, we all have probably a similar call to this one, not in necessarily the facts of the call, but how it kind of rattles the cage of identity. So I was dispatched to a structure fire July of 2005. And my partner and I were midnight cops. We were doored up. We were talking about whatever midnight cops talk about. And dispatch aired that it was a mom and a child who were trapped in a second story apartment and it was fully engulfed. And mom was screaming for us to get there to help. So I remember looking out my driver's side window to the south, to where the direction of the fire, and seeing the flames just kind of licking the atmosphere. And my partner and I went code 3, which is lights and sirens, to the call, and dispatch continued to give updates that the mom was no longer speaking to them, that they could just hear her breathing, and then the line cut out. So when we arrived, my partner and I ran up to the building, and I remember being close enough to the building that I could feel the heat on my skin, the sting of it, and looking up at the second story window and thinking I should throw my flashlight, my mag light, at the window to crack it so that they could get some air, which isn't the right thing to do for a fire, but just to give you kind of the idea, I was grasping it. What can I do to help? There's a surreal moment, and I still to this day kind of feel it, where I can kind of see myself outside of my body. Like I zoom out and I see myself holding my flashlight and looking up at this window. And it's in that moment that I recognize that these sort of ideas that I had going in about being able to do anything and help anyone were kind of shattered. And I recognize that regardless of the position, that is still subject to the rules of being human. And there was literally nothing that I could do to make change in the situation. So ultimately the mother and the child died in the fire. And I was riddled with all of the traditional symptoms or typical symptoms of PTSD. I had nightmares for years where the mom would meet me in my dreams and yell at me, scream at me for not saving her and her baby. But I just didn't address it because, you know, during that time, we didn't. And I felt like if I acknowledged the fact that I was struggling with this call or emoting about this call, that it somehow took away from my ability to do this job. And this is a job that I believed my destiny was kind of around since I was a little girl, reading my dad's books. Like this was the only path for me. So I think admitting to the fact that I was struggling with something involving the job was just not an option. I had to keep going. So that was kind of like a bookmark in my career that definitely left an impression that I forever tried to mitigate and grow from.
There's no doubt that in that moment, I'm sure many people probably consoled you. I'm sure they weren't using that etymology, but were saying, hey, you did all you can do. There was nothing we could do to help. It was all the things that fall short of aiding in the internal thoughts and beliefs of which you failed. I mean, I'm being presumptuous in what I'm saying here, but in your mind, I'm more asking that as a question. Is that not where you felt, hey, I failed them somehow, or I didn't do what I could have done to save them? It's my fault. Something along those lines. Is that right?
Absolutely. Like, I think that as first responders, we feel like we get when we get called, we're there to help. We're there to save. Sure. We're there to make change.
Absolutely.
And when we can't, it feels like, a tremendous amount of failure, a failure at your identity, if you will. Like, you are supposed to be, or this, there's an idea that you're supposed to be the person who is able to make those changes and help the others. But in this particular situation, again, you have to, what I didn't recognize was my own humanity in that situation.
Sure.
I can put a badge and a gun on and a vest and, you know, have all these tools and whatever, but at the end of the day, I'm still a person.
Right.
And there's only so much I can do.
So when did you know something was off? Like, something that you were carrying that in your backpack, that you were going to start taking this around with you everywhere?
I would say immediately following the call. Like, I remember dictating my report in the police department parking lot and just sobbing. And then my partners, who were, as you said, like, well-meaning, wanting to sure. help, asked me if I was okay. But then the follow-up was, are you still going to be able to do the job? And I remember just being like kind of shaken by that question. Like, of course I'm still able to do the job. Like, this is what I was designed to do.
Sure.
And so there was this idea that I needed to prove myself, not just to my partners, but to myself.
To yourself.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that in those moments immediately following, I knew that I was rattled. Like, everything that I thought I was capable of, I recognized that I wasn't. And it was a reckoning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did that look like in daily living after that? Sleep, eating, isolation, drinking, any of those topics change for you?
Well, immediately following, I exhibited some behavior that I learned later. It's called mastery. So I started going to all the fire calls just to show that I could work my way through mm-hmm. them. And I ended up becoming a crimes against persons detective to save all the babies. Like, I couldn't save the baby in the fire, but I was going to save all the rest of them,
mm-hmm.
however I could. So again, that idea and concept of mastery started showing up. If you were to look at me in my career or in my professional life, everything seemed fine. Like, I did a great job at work. I was reliable. I had a good reputation at the DA's office. I was well respected in my agency, all the things. But the fallout was happening more at home. So to your point, drinking or isolation at home from my family. The analogy I like to use is that I felt like I was watching a movie of my family, but I wasn't playing a part in it. So I was very disconnected from the relationships that mattered to me. Work was everything. I was consumed by it and a need to sort of prove myself in a professional way, but my family always took the back seat. So it created issues.
And did you realize your family was taking a back seat? I mean, right away, did it have to be pointed out to you? A lot of times we still get so focused on work that we're not paying attention as much to what happens at home, even though we know what's happening. So how did you become aware that that was going on?
I think, that's a great question. There's two, relevant things to bring up. So when my father was in the FBI, he missed countless birthdays and countless special occasions with my family. And my mother would always tell me that another child needed him more, you know? So, like, we'll be able to make up this time, but somebody else needs your dad right now, and he has to go help him. So when I was getting having the ability to get called out or whatever, help with all of these situations. In my mind, how I was justifying it was somebody else needs me more, right? My kids are going to be okay. These kids need me. So I had that going on in the background of my mind. As far as like, did it get brought to my attention? I think there was one clear day or whatever where I was confronted by my ex-husband at the time, or he was my husband at the time, I guess. Now he's my ex-husband. But he made a point about my apathy towards everyone else in my life. So the circumstances were the night before I'd gotten called out on a murder. There was a woman who got stabbed in the eye. It was a horrific case, and my team was out until, I don't know, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And so I was home after that call out, and he was telling me about some personal development group that he was a part of, and that a woman in the group was lamenting about issues with her mom and dad, and she was upset and she was crying and whatever. And I remember telling him, you know, like, at least she didn't get stabbed in the eye. Like, things are going a-okay. Like, things could be a hell of a lot worse, right? Like, like, put on your big girl pants. We all have problems with our moms and our dads. So, like, get over it. And I remember feeling in that moment, like, wow, this job has given me such perspective. Like, I have so much to be grateful for. And, like, you know, things are going all right. And he threw back, he's like, you know, Siobhan, a cup of pain is a cup of pain. And what is painful for her is very real to her. And I was like, huh, okay. And I chewed on it, you know, for a while. First, I was like, whatever. But after I thought about it for a while, I recognized how disconnected I had become from regular people, like, including my family. Like, if you didn't have big T trauma, I didn't have time for you. Like, I didn't care about your skin knee. I didn't care about, you know, the little BS that you had going on in your life. Like, if you weren't dying or something horrific didn't happen to you, you weren't even on my radar. So it was eye-opening. And I continue to reflect on that moment and try to make sure that I'm cognizant that people's problems matter tremendously to them, and it doesn't, there's no spectrum. Yeah, a cup of pain is a cup of pain.
Isn't it fascinating that perspective is often prevalent within our community and our culture, that we see such, to your reference of big T, little T trauma, such big T trauma so often, that this, it brings about this perspective of, well, that's not that big a deal. And I think what comes to mind for me with that oftentimes is our children, where it's, oh, it's just a skint knee. At least you're alive. You know, we seem within our families, or probably sometimes even within our intimate relationships, it's not that big a deal. I'm here, you know, pull up your big boy pants and let's move on with life. And in that moment, we've missed an opportunity to connect with somebody and empathize with their cup of pain, as you put it. Yeah, what a what a great lesson, you know, that can be had in that moment. Yeah.
It's powerful. And I do think it's our default setting. It's a bandwidth issue. So like, when we look at people's struggles and our capacity to hold space for them, we only have so much energy or bandwidth to help. And so I think that we largely use that bandwidth for the people, the community that we serve. And when we get home, our families get whatever's left, right? Which sometimes isn't much.
Right. Exactly. No, that is so good. So if we're going to ask again, maybe a little more about what you're experiencing and what your life, what you're living out life there. Thank you for sharing that. And how long does this kind of continue, this space? I'll frame it out in that verbiage, this space, you just go on like this for how long before you recognize something's off on me?
So it was many years. I was existing like this through 2019, when I had another case that was similar enough to the fire that it kind of unpacked everything for me. So, mm-hmm. you know, up until that point, I've flirted with the idea of therapy, but never really invested any time in it. I had gone and seen a therapist for panic attacks. And I remember sitting across from her and telling her that I was struggling with a case that happened in 2013. And I was telling her about how the case had been successfully resolved, and I didn't understand why I was having these issues with panic at benign times. Like, I was on a run with girlfriends and my heart rate would just start, my heart would start pounding my chest and I couldn't catch my breath. And it had nothing to do with the run. It had to do with panic. So anyways, I was sitting across from her and I was like, yeah, I'm here for a 2013 case that I'm trying to resolve in my mind. And she was through EAP and she's like, what's 2013? And I was like, it's a year. And I laughed. I was like, if I have to explain a year to you, you're never going to understand my job. And I didn't go back. Fast forward to 2019.
Hold on here. There's something I want to dive into. So you found this clinician was not connecting with you on your language or culture within the first responder community, specifically law enforcement. Yes. Is that fair?
Yes, very fair.
And
yeah.
How frustrating was that? Because this happens a lot.
Yeah, it does. It was super frustrating. Like, I think as first responders, it takes a lot for us to even make the phone call,
right,
saying we need help. And I think that the clinicians who serve our community need to understand that they have one shot, right? Like, if they screw up that first meeting, we're done.
Right.
We're not going back, probably ever, unless,
go ahead, Max.
How long did, after that one where you had to explain 2013, how long was it before you decided to give somebody else a try?
Probably 4 years. Yeah. Probably not till 2019. And that was when I came face to face with like the fact that I was really struggling with trauma.
Yeah.
So, and it was unavoidable anymore. So sure. I don't think, had I not had that like tipping point, that I would have gone back. I probably would have just kept keeping on.
Sure.
Because we're really good at burying things.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're exceptional at putting on the stoic sort of face, right? And working our way through high stress issues and like, yeah, it's what we get paid to do. So we're very proficient at it.
So that tipping point, we're at that tipping point and you're looking, and walk us through that then. Where do you go?
So I, the background for that tipping point was, I was assigned a case in 2019. It was a mother who lost her son in a shooting. So the circumstances were different, but aligned enough that it started to kind of unravel everything that I had kept so tightly held within. So her boy was in his 20s, and another boy who was also in his 20s were drunk in a room together playing with guns, and then the gun went off and her son was killed as a result. The case was initially investigated by our property crimes unit because they were on call at the time. And it was closed as accidental, self-inflicted. And mom was really upset with that resolution. So it was my job to reinvestigate the case and see if we had missed anything. And because of my expertise in dealing with suspicious deaths and murders, it landed on my desk. So I worked the case. There was things we could have done better for sure. But really the personal connect here was this mother was outraged at the police department and how they had handled her son's investigation. Mm-hmm. And I was at the receiving end of her rage. So who she represented to me was she personified the mother who had met me in my dream so many years mm-hmm. before from the fire and made me like abundantly aware that I had never addressed these things in the past. Mm. So everything came unpacked.
When did you realize this, make this connection? Did you make it pretty early or was it later in the case that you started making this correlation?
It was later in the case. Like still even up to that point, I didn't draw the parallel.
Yeah.
You know, it took me a while to figure out that that was what it was.
Yeah.
That same sense of helplessness, like all of the things that were attached to that fire call were definitely there.
I find this fascinating that and this happens a lot in stories that I've heard, but I find it fascinating if you don't mind, what is going on in your life then at home? Like this, I would guess there's things changing because there's things happening that you don't even know or consciously realize that are happening. You're making this, your mind is making this connection. So consequently, is your sleep differently? Is your eating differently? Are you drinking more or less? Your relationships, you know, how's all that going? Or was it the same?
No, I think that it was like my foot was on the gas pedal with all of those things. So I felt numb. It was like I couldn't connect with my emotions. They were there,
mm-hmm.
Like overwhelmingly so, but I wasn't able to feel them. With my relationships, I was becoming increasingly withdrawn. Like my friends were, Siobhan, you're usually so happy. Like what happened? Like what's going on? How do we help you? I'm like, I don't know. And it made me feel even more broken, right? Like their assessment
right.
of me, like
right.
how come I can't keep it together anymore? And like just exhaustion, like the simplest things were so hard to do, like typing a report. I remember staring at my computer for like 45 minutes, just being like, type, like it's not hard type, but it was hard. It was like having these anvils on my hands. Like I couldn't move them.
Right.
It was strange to not have control over my body or my mind or my sleep. Like to your point, nightmares were more and more prevalent. Like I was fighting demons all the time in my dreams, but never able to like successfully win. It was terrible.
Oh, that's great. So again, thank you for letting me jump in here and chime in and ask some more detailed questions specific to that. This is so good. Okay, so now what? Are we consciously recognizing something's off? Do we seek help? Where does Siobhan go here?
Yeah, so it kind of reached a boiling point, and I think one of the moments that I remember being like, wow, something is super wrong. Like there's this background idea that something is wrong, you know, but the clarity around it, came, I was at a restaurant and was sitting, waiting for the waitress to come over and ask me for my order. And she was like, would you like any coffee? And I remember my eyes just like watering up with tears. And it was so weird because I hadn't cried for years, right? Like so much had happened and I never cried about it. And she asked me if I wanted coffee and I wanted to burst into tears. And it was like, what is wrong with my body? Like, why can't I hold on to this anymore? So yeah, that was just a strong, I guess, slap in the face of like, you got to fix this. Like whatever is going on, it's beyond your ability to control it anymore. It's time to address it.
And the waitress was like, I'm just trying to give you some coffee.
Yeah, she's like, what's
the coffee's not now? That bad. I promise.
Yeah. Right.
Oh.
Yeah. It was wild. And then there was another moment too, which I think ultimately was a greater tipping point. I had gotten called out on a stabbing, I don't know, the week before or whatever. And a guy had gotten eviscerated at a park. He was stabbed in the belly and his guts were not where they were supposed to be. He was transported to a local hospital, and I was out on the call for, I don't know, a few hours, and got it neutralized, went back to the PD, put in my hours, and then went home. And then the following week, it was like paycheck or time card day or whatever. And my boss called me into her office and she's like, Siobhan, she's like, I was reviewing your telestaff, which was the program that we used. And she's like, you entered your telestaff in wrong. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. She's like, well, you know, if I didn't catch it, then you would have had to write the city a check. And I was like, well, thanks for catching it. You know, I'll do better next time. And she's like, I think it was like a clerical error. I'd written 14 or 0230 instead of 1430 or whatever. Like I entered the time wrong. And she's like, Siobhan, you're a great detective, but you have to be good at the admin stuff too. And I was like, I get it. Like, thanks. And I was like, you know what? Like, to her credit, she handled me very well. I said, I don't give a F about the money. I was like, it was never about the money. Like, I care about getting this victim through whatever happened to her.
Sure.
I don't give a F about this. I care about this. And I mother F'd my boss for probably a solid 5 minutes, telling her about how I didn't care about the money, keep the F and money. And I care about these victims and getting them through whatever they're going through. And she listened to me. And then she's like, you know what, Siobhan, I think we failed you. Like, as a department, you're carrying a lot right now. We need to get you some help. And she gave me a hug. And that was kind of like what set the ball rolling on, I need help. Because I am a very even-keeled person. And so that sort of disruptive response to a pretty benign issue was completely outside of my character, and it was kudos to her to recognize that.
And did you, how did you take that? Did you MF her again when she said that, or did you go, oh man, I think you're right?
Oh no. I gave her a hug, but it was like a guarded hug. And I was like, I need to leave for the rest of the day. And I left. So we had follow-up conversations, and she was very kind during those conversations. But I think initially I wasn't ready to hear it, really. Like, sure. I still thought that I was okay, and it was everybody else's fault. It wasn't my fault, that, you know, like that I was feeling burnt out or overworked or whatever. It was nothing to do with me. It was all external. And I think as I started to kind of wade through my issues, I recognized that it was me. The lack of bandwidth and sense of overwhelm was because I hadn't dealt with all of these things that I'd been exposed to throughout the course of my career, specifically the fire. But, you know, there's always more. And yeah, so it was time to.
Well, I think from a perspective of frontline perspective of looking at leadership, we oftentimes take this stance of leadership is always against us. And in that moment, you had a very, very visceral response to a very pragmatic conversation of, hey, we need to get you to fix some admin stuff. And you're like, go pound sand. Yeah. Which is, to your leadership's credit, to this young or this leader's credit, wow, what an amazing response in that moment to see what you, you know, maybe not what you needed, but certainly the direction you needed to go. And I won't pretend to know what she was thinking, but clearly her response was, hey, this emotion doesn't match the content of our conversation. Something's off, and come join you in that space instead of actually saying, get the F out, and don't come back. By the way, that was, I got kicked out of a unit doing that very thing of cussing my commander. And he said, go check out a patrol car because you're going back to the road. I had that same thing. And, you know, he was a great friend too. You know, I've made apologies since then over that very, but I've been where you're at. I mean, in that space of, turns out that moment happened, you know, just a mere, 4 months after I'd lost a very dear friend in the line of duty. And I never made that connection until years later, several years later, I made that connection of, that makes sense why I was responding, you know, in that emotional space or a really ugly, visceral response to a very, he was doing the same thing, just bringing up an issue, go pound sand. And let me tell you how to pound it. And So I get that. So do you seek help then, or does she help you, or do you department resources? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, my department was great. So they plugged me in with resources. I was formally diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety, and depression. They were great about getting me services. I ended up connecting with this wonderful therapist in Cheyenne who had a law enforcement background. She was a retired cop and could relate. So it was a powerful experience in starting to face some of these scarier things, like that I hadn't addressed until that time.
Powerful. Well, I don't want to condense that down because that's a lot, but for time purposes, because there's so much more that I'd really like to unpack with you, let's take a quick journey through your healing, because I'm really fascinated with this journey of health that you're on now, because you're it's very holistic, if memory serves me correct, and I want to save some space to talk a little bit about that. But as you enter into this, are you willing? Are you seeing yourself as in this space of, I do need help. I do need somebody to help me connect the dots on why I'm in this space. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I kind of surrendered, if you will, to the fact that I did need help and I needed to face these demons.
How was that journey?
It was hard. I think, you know, the most courageous thing that we can do is to look inside and to recognize that we all have stuff. And I think that we as law enforcement do a really good job of, again, masking our emotions, being the cool, calm, collected one all the time. And we don't address our own humanity. And you know, regardless of how tough you are or your background or how well trained you are, you're still a human being and you're still subject to the rules of being human. That's the bottom line. So that it's tough to recognize that and be vulnerable. Our profession is not good at being vulnerable. It's seen as weakness. And I think that's where the narrative needs to start changing. That's why we're losing cops all the time to their own guns, because we're so wanting to put on this image of strength while we struggle inside and don't face what's going on within us.
Sure. No, that's pretty. It's pretty common. It is a. I love. We talk about that courageous moment a lot on this podcast about these. And sometimes it's just tiny steps of courage of picking up the phone or to call a buddy or call a peer team member, or dare say even calling a clinician and saying, hey, I need to visit, cold call, you know, taking that first step. And we talk a lot about that on this podcast of really courageous moments. So we're getting healthy, and I do want to save some space as we're talking about this, because you're on a great path now, correct?
I am. Yeah, it's been exciting.
So what does that look like? Tell us what that looks like, because there's, you know, when you and I talked before, there was a lot of fascinating things that you were doing to stay on this journey. Because PTSD is a manageable diagnosis, meaning you have to, you have to manage it daily, or it comes back and rears its ugly head.
Yeah, so I started researching all things wellness. I took a break from police work. I went on a sabbatical, and I started studying and really immersing myself in the research around how do I heal? Like, how do I get better? And I saw a therapist, and then I started kind of diving into the research around resilience models and practicing them, being very intentional about my habits. And then from that, my world started to regain color. And I started to become frustrated that I hadn't had these tools going into my career. And I was just learning about them, you know, 16 years in or whatever. And so because of that, I started advocating and speaking out about the tools that I had used to heal in order to help my Blue family and hopefully work on the prevention piece of things. Like, we're so good at intervening when the situation becomes critical, right? Like myself, mine included, like it reached a point where it had to be addressed. We do not do a good job as an industry about prevention. What can we do to mitigate this so that it doesn't reach a critical point? So I started talking about it more openly, and then got asked to speak. And it's never something that I thought I would ever be doing. It kind of fell into my lap. And it still, like, surprises me at times that people care, like, what my opinion is. Like, but, you know, it's been an honor and just a strange journey. But I feel like having the opportunity to share and allow people to see themselves in my story has been very therapeutic for me, because again, it shows me I'm not alone. Like, there's been countless times where people have approached me after a presentation and been like, wow, like, I thought you were talking right to me during this thing.
I know that you found a lot, but if there were one or two or maybe even three things that are really substantially important for you to communicate in this, or for your life, or something you wanted to pass on, what would one or two of those be, of like, here's something that is enormously impactful that you can do daily, hourly, weekly? What would those be?
So there's five things that I like to teach on that I say saved my life. And those are gratitude, changing my diet, movement, connection, and breath work. And I think that the two that are most important for police officers to consider are the gratitude and the connection piece. At the beginning of this podcast, we talked about that relationship that I established with that victim's brother and how he became Santa Claus for my kids. And when I focus on that, that gives me something to be grateful for about that tragic situation that was highly emotional and horrible. There was a glimmer of hope, something that truly mattered and has such depth that allowed me to reframe, if you will, that particular scenario. So using your being intentional about how we're viewing things, right? About how we're viewing a case, how we're viewing our relationship to the case, how we're viewing our healing process, or the helping this victim through their healing process, finding great opportunity to be grateful within those moments, those cornerstones in our career. So gratitude is huge. It helps to regulate the nervous system. It helps to de-stress the body. It has an anti-aging effect. I mean, there's countless things that gratitude does to help us, and it's free. So it just requires reframing. And then the other is connection. So we often lone wolf our lives and think that we have to hold on to everything and not share because we don't want to traumatize other people or whatever. I think, again, recognizing that we're more alike than we're different. We're all playing by the rules of being human, and seeking out those trusted relationships to share these stories of hardship helps you recognize that you're not alone in your struggle, and that your struggle, while unique to you, is a story that many have gone through and gotten to the other side of. And so leaning in to those safe people and sharing helps you in your healing process as well.
So let's back up a little bit to the gratitude, and I would actually really like to spend a little bit of time on all five of these, if you don't mind.
This
gratitude piece, I love your philosophical viewpoint on the fact that it's free, because so many people think that they're, and I talk about this a lot as well, but people who are in a resistant state feel like you're emptying their bank account to get them to be grateful for something. When the simple reality is it's a mindset change that is enormously beneficial to your mind, body, spirit, physically, spiritually, so many different levels. And especially if you can make it become a way of life, of just improving not only your mood, but your way of life. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we in the West, we're a little behind in how we approach the mind-body connection. So, you know, in Eastern medicine, they've had their head wrapped around this idea for centuries, right? Like, they talk about the mind-body connection and just being really intentional about how their mind is impacting their body. We in the West are just coming around to this concept, and we've rebranded it, and we're calling it neuroscience. And so now all of a sudden it's okay because we have a scientific term behind it. But
we've proved true. That it works scientifically, when the reality is they've known this for centuries,
for decades, centuries.
Yeah. Right. It's woo, right? Like when we look at it as skeptics, it's woo-woo, it's hippie granola stuff, and it's not for us. But when we call it neuroscience, somehow it's more approachable and,
you know, means something.
Yeah, exactly. But like there's tons of research on mind-body connection and how our thoughts impact our body and our body impacts our thoughts. And so when we look at ourselves as a whole person and recognize that how you're thinking about something is impacting your physical health, it almost motivates you to be more conscientious about how you're thinking about a problem or how you're thinking about your life. And when you start to shift the way you're thinking about problems and life, it impacts the body in a beautiful way. Chemically, it changes the way that your body is working. So gratitude produces a chemical called oxytocin, and oxytocin neutralizes stress. So if we can figure out what there is to be grateful for, then you almost have the inoculation for stress. So it does require discipline. It's hard, especially when you're living in a cynical world, you're surrounded by cynical people. It's tough to figure out what there is to be grateful for. But I think, you know, sometimes we have to remember, like when we're in that despairing sort of call or case or situation where the world is falling apart for these people that we're trying to help, sometimes the thing to be grateful for is just our own involvement in helping to break up that tragedy for the victim that we're serving. Sometimes we are the thing to be grateful for, you know? Sure. So Yeah, it's just, yeah, I don't know. Again, it requires it things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's powerful.
No, agreed. I find it fascinating that you would be hard pressed to find something to be that you can't be grateful for in many of these scenarios or circumstances of life. It's a matter of looking and focusing on the right things, because oftentimes you find people who say there is nothing to be grateful for in this, but ultimately, even the case you presented early on about, you know, this, your Santa Claus friend, you know, in that moment, you've made a connection, which is the number two that you just presented, which is these, you know, making sure you're connected with people, other air breathers on this globe that we're wandering around on. But more specifically, the connections to a tribe of somebody who's going to care for you and love you and be honest with you and hold you accountable and tell you where your missteps are and something about how you can shore up and give that same feedback. And now you have these connections that are powerful. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Well, let me push us towards the last three, because I actually want to give you this space to talk about all the other three. Breath work. Talk a little bit about the breathwork piece.
So breathwork is such an easy tool for us to use as officers. And it's, I don't know, it's non-obtrusive. Like, nobody knows you're doing it. So how breath works is when you inhale, it activates your sympathetic nervous system, meaning it activates the part of your body that is prepared to act on an issue. It prepares you for movement. And when you breathe out, it activates your parasympathetic nervous system. And your parasympathetic nervous system is rest and digest. So when you're breathing evenly, you're in homeostasis, right? So you're able to respond to a stimulus, but you're also relaxed and aware. Most of us are over-breathing, we're over-oxygenating our blood. We're taking short, choppy inhales, which the research shows is the behavior that precipitates a panic attack, because it's changing the alkalinity level of your body. So when we find ourselves in a stressful situation, it's important to focus on the exhale, because the exhale helps to relax the body and allows you more access to the bigger part of your brain, which is your prefrontal cortex. So when we're stressed, our prefrontal cortex goes offline, and the prefrontal cortex controls your discretionary decision-making powers, your ability to see big picture. It's where all the good stuff in your brain lives, but you don't get to have access to it when you're stressed. So what breath does is it brings your parasympathetic nervous system online and helps you regulate your nervous system or downshift your nervous system so that you can access that bigger part of your brain and have more options for solutions than the impulsive side of your brain allows you to think about.
So mom was always right when you said, she said, hey, take a deep breath.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so I think if I remember right, the other two were diet and movement. Is that right?
Yeah, yes.
So give us a little blurb on those.
Okay, so diet, you have this nerve in your body. It's called the vagus nerve or the vagabond nerve, and it connects your brain to all of the organs in your body. And it serves as a bilateral communicator between your body and your brain and your brain and your body. The majority of the communication that is going on in your body is from the body to the brain. 80% of the communication on this bilateral highway is your body telling your brain how it's feeling. So your brain is the number one consumer of micronutrients in your body. And most of us in law enforcement are not feeding our bodies correctly. We're feeding our bodies, highly processed foods, right? Yeah. So
bag of chips and a candy bar.
Right. A monster, right? Like, yeah, it's not good.
Pizza and a Sprite. That's my diet. Pizza and a Sprite. Anything right. with pasta or carbs.
Corn dog from.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Right. So knowing that your brain is the number one consumer of micronutrients in your body, and when we're feeding it these textured chemicals, we're not going to get what we need to out of it. So we need to start being more, again, intentional about what we're putting into our body to get the best output from our brain. So there was a study done by this New Zealand doctor called the Smiles Trial, and she studied the effects of the Mediterranean diet on people who had moderate to severe depression. And she found that through eating clean, that she was able to, or that these participants with moderate to severe depression showed a, what do you call it? They went into remission with their depression at a rate of 37%, which is equal to a lot of antidepressants that are prescribed. And that's just through changing the way we're eating. Like, it's powerful stuff. And it's, again, it's really cost effective. Like, eat a pepper, you know, what is that? 50 cents? Like, we can do this, but we have to be intentional about our choices and discipline. So the results are great.
Well, I know that, and I don't want to get into a whole debate on our food industry, but the sugar is typically in a lot of these things that we grab off the shelf first, which is cold cereal or some type of, you know, something that tastes good within, which is easier and more of a go-to. But I do know, and personally know some of the differences that a diet has made in my life personally, and it might have been subtle. But I've talked to several people. In fact, I had a brother-in-law that went down the road of diet changing. He did pass from cancer, but his life extended at length. The quality of life extended as a result of him changing his diet at the recommendation of some people who were, it wasn't pro food industry of our current food industry. It was very much against, but that's a whole philosophical debate for another day. But I do know a little bit about, enough about it to know that we are what we eat. And if you want to be healthy, then making a even subtle food changes in our diet would be dramatically different in how we felt about ourselves and lived our life.
And it doesn't take a whole lot of time. I mean, in the Morgan household these last month, we're working on eating better, eating healthier, and making some better choices in what we put in our bodies. And it's amazing in the last few weeks, the changes in, like, my two boys that are still living at home, myself, my wife, you know, just by making a few better choices with, you know, maybe a little less sugar, a little less candy, you know, can't quit that cold turkey, but got to have a little bit.
That's right.
But no, it's amazing the changes that it makes.
Well, the last one is movement.
Yes. So with movement, again, like, when you're placed in a stressful situation, whether, you know, you're checking emails or you're actually responding to a hot call, your body starts to get flooded with these chemicals that prepare you to move in some way, right? You're either going to fight or you're going to run. That's the whole system is designed for those two things.
Sure.
So when we get to the call or we check the email or whatever, and there's nothing that we need to address through movement, all of these chemicals are still floating around in our body that were designed to be metabolized for this particular goal or stressor that we're going to face. So what movement does is it helps you metabolize those chemicals faster so that you can get access again to that prefrontal cortex, that bigger part of your brain, more quickly. So it's a static way for you to metabolize the chemicals and get your nervous system regulated so that you can experience the joys of being human, being relaxed, aware, all of these things, connection, by, again, regulating your nervous system. So I think just starting small, taking a walk to the mailbox and then, you know, building off of that to your half marathon goal or whatever, is important, because a lot of us set these lofty goals that we're not going to be able to achieve. We fail, and then we don't come back to the goal. We table it, right? So those SMART goals are important.
Sure.
They need to be attainable and then built off of.
And one of the most obvious, I think, I'll put a word to one that comes to mind immediately, is that cortisol dump of how bad that actually can be if you don't get that out of your system. And one of the more obvious that everybody would love is these, you know, is to be slim and trim. Well, cortisol is directly affects your fat retention, your body fat retention. If it's not if it's not dealt with properly, you're going to start getting a rubber tire or saddlebags. I mean, that's just the nature of that's research. That's where it's going. And at its simplest form. But if you go even deeper than that, to your point, I love where you're going with this, all of this, you know, cortisol dramatically impairs us, on many levels. And it's a great drug when we need it for the right time. It's not a very good drug when we hang on to it too long. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely fair. Yeah. I think it's just, again, like the idea of having intention behind your thoughts, mm-hmm. what you're putting into your body, how you're using your body, and that self-awareness to understand when you are being activated, your nervous system is being activated, yeah. and then the steps you can do to fall back in line and be comfortable again.
I love this. So gratitude, breathwork, movement, diet, connection. I love the five pillars that you speak of, and Siobhan, this has been absolutely great conversation. Thank you so much. If I'm going to kind of wrap us up here. If you had any tips for people that have been listening on how to get a hold of you or how to make connection with you, where would they find Siobhan? Maybe they wanted to follow up on these 5 points, or maybe even have you come speak. How would they get a hold of Siobhan?
I think the best way is probably through LinkedIn. Just shoot me a message on that, and I'm happy to help however I can. I'm definitely an advocate for my first responder brothers and sisters, so anything that I can do to help, I'd like to be a part of.
Oh, I love that. Max, any final thoughts?
Siobhan, thank you for being on with us. I loved hearing your story. I loved hearing that you're much better on the back end and doing well on your journey. So thank you.
Siobhan, I'd love to hear you cuss sometime. You just seem so sweet that you just don't have it in you. So you're just dropping the F word sometime. Love that. Siobhan, thank you so much. You're a delight. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.